Hey everybody, it's Brian. Before I did this Seahawks stuff full-time, I worked as a manager and senior leader, so I know how lonely it can be to try to find someone you trust to talk through people issues, org issues, process issues as you try to lead an organization. Ryan Cleveland of RyanCleveland.com is someone I trust to have those conversations with. He specializes in working with CEOs and business owners, and you can get a complimentary free discovery session to see if it's a good fit for you. Just go to RyanCleveland.com to sign up and start now. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Real Hawk Talk. Yes, it's a Real Hawk Talk episode, even though we are in the mornings, or in the morning, I should say. We got to have Real Hawk Talk on a game week, and the only two folks that are not actively celebrating Christmas, Jeff Simmons and myself, are happy to start your Christmas morning talking about Seahawks. Hopefully you're all doing well. Hopefully you're got all the presents you wanted, gave all the presents you wanted, had all the food and all the stuff, and are bundled up on the couch ready for a football day. Jeff, man, how are you doing down there in Florida?
I'm good. I'm outside right now. I was at the pool this morning. I'm ready to watch a bunch of third string quarterbacks.
I saw that on Twitter, man. You're like reacting to somebody saying how bad the slate was, and you're like, yeah, and I'm going to watch all of it. I don't know if I'm going to watch any of it, man. It's so bad.
That's healthy. That's much healthier than I'm going to be playing inside with my son, and it's going to be on.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. If I've got a young kid around and I'm not going anywhere, I think that makes some sense.
Yeah, if I had freedom with my day, I would be outside all day. I wouldn't watch any.
I mean, Rachel and I last night found ourselves like searching for old movies that we hadn't watched for a while, and we watched a Will Ferrell, Amy Poehler movie called House. The House.
Do you remember this? I remember that movie
where they like set up a casino in their neighborhood. It was so panned. Like, I think it had like 20% Rotten Tomatoes. We've seen it before, but neither one of us could remember almost anything about it. That was a fun movie, man. It delivered. We were laughing quite a bit last night, and you know, growing up around folks that like everybody celebrates Christmas. You know, I certainly got my fair share of the Christmas story and, you know, the debates around Die Hard and all that stuff. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I saw that the other night again. That movie cracks me up. Do you have a Christmas movie that you enjoy when it comes on?
Not really. I've been kind of isolated from Christmas a lot of my life, and my grandparents bought a place in Florida that we're still coming to. And as a kid, the only time to see my grandparents was coming down here in December. And so we always would just hang out, watch movies. We used to go to the movies a lot. And now it's just with Netflix and everything, I don't even go to the movies a lot. And now I have one of these Fire Sticks where I can literally Google anything and put it in any movie. I watched Almost Famous last night, which is one of my favorite movies.
That's a good flick.
Yeah, it's just that movie gets me every time. We watched Lucky Number 11 the other day. I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's a really good movie. I've seen it before, but it's just really good cast. No, I just try to watch movies with the hangout with the family. That's honestly it.
Yeah, well, I went around the locker room yesterday must have asked 15 players what their favorite Christmas gift was that they ever got. And there's a lot of good ones. I want to play for you. This is Gray Zabel's answer. Gray Zabel, favorite Christmas present you got growing up?
I'm going to go with, we got a 120cc miniature snowmobile growing up. And in the South Dakotas, it snows from like October through March. So that was a pretty hot commodity. Having that in the neighborhood, riding that around the house and stuff in the yard and stuff is pretty sweet.
Now, was it big enough that you could get like double up on it? Someone standing, someone sitting?
You got to remember, we were probably 8 to 12 years old.
That's when you do stupid things, man.
Yeah, you'd pull the sleds and stuff. I mean, we did everything. We took it through a rose bush. We took it through my dad's grill. Like, it was basically indestructible back then. It was elite. We got two of them, so that's probably my favorite for sure.
Love it. Love it. Yeah, there's really good ones, but I mean, is there anyone else that was more fitting to have a miniature snowmobile than Gray Zabel?
That was so on brand. I was surprised he didn't say like a case of Bush Light or something, but probably started getting that when he was like 9 years old. But that is so funny. That's a perfect Zabel answer.
Yeah, yeah. Anthony Bradford was funny. He got a Mongoose bike with like front and back pegs, and I was like, man. How big were you back then? I gotta ask, dude, because like I'm imagining you on the pegs of that thing. You must have worn that thing out. He's like, I was pretty big.
Yeah, so. Like, well, how big of a bike was that dude? Yeah, I don't know how big he was. I saw him at LSU, and he must have been a kid at that point. But holy shit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's funny because I mean, a lot of these guys are, I mean, they're almost all in their 20s, or and some of them are, you know, very low 20s. So it's like not that long ago. I was talking to Eric Saubert, and he said he dated himself because he was like, oh, well, my favorite present was a Nintendo 64. And Drew Locke was right next to him. And he's like, well, you are dating yourself because mine was the GameCube, which was kind of next.
Oh, man. I died at GameCube.
And they were talking about who's better at Mario Kart. And I'm like, well, why you guys have all these competitions in this locker room? Why don't you settle it? Like, why isn't Mario Kart all over this place? And I saw a light bulb go off. Apparently, so the Nintendo Switch, you can connect a bunch of those. And they did that when Saubert and Locke were together in Denver on the team plane. And they're like, oh, we're going to have to bring that back. So we'll have to find out, check in a little later if Mario Kart is being played on the Seahawks team plane and who is king of the kart.
That's awesome. Every team should have an N64 set up with GoldenEye and Mario Kart, even Mario Party, Mario Tennis. But I'm probably dating ourselves. These guys in their early 20s probably wouldn't have a clue what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. It was fun. For folks that want to hear all of the different Christmas present stories from the guys, patreon.com/hawkblogger. I've got the audio up there for everybody. And it's also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify for anyone who wants to listen. So a lot of good stuff there. There's also some sound I wanted to play for you because I thought it was one, I was channeling you, who would like to see 100% play action rate from the Seahawks offense, and asked Clint Kubiak, I was like, for people that just don't know all the ins and outs and they see how well play action's working, like, why don't people just run it all the time? And let me play this for you, and we'll listen to his answer.
I think that the game is about balance. You know, when you can be balanced and be harder to defend, it just makes all your plays come to life better. If you're one dimensional and teams can dial in on when you're running and passing, then it makes it hard.
When a quarterback is play faking, is he sort of sacrificing some time, like where he's looking down the field and reading defenses? Is there a give and take there?
Yeah, there is. But, you know, Sam does a great job. He can turn his back to the defense and get keyed in back to his defender he's looking at. So that's a big skill. A guy playing in play action offense is, you know, being able to re-ID the defense after you get your eyes back around.
So I don't feel like he necessarily understood the question. But it's one I'm going to kind of come back to because there are reasons why you don't do play action all the time. But I'm curious for you as someone who's been heavily advocating for more of it, you know, what's your take, Jeff?
My guess is what he was trying to say is that for it to be effective, you need some sort of deception. And if you lose the deception, the play action, that's a deception play at best. Teams just started like in Atlanta in the first half had all their play action figured out. They were blitzing it every time. And I remember turning to you in the press box before it actually started working. I'm like, this play action game is being completely red. And then they hit it like seven of them in a row. But I'm guessing that's what he was saying. If you, the whole, like, it's good he doesn't say you need to run the ball. I know he kind of had some comments like that when you asked him when he first got hired. But I see what he's saying. Like, you are giving up something in terms of, he probably doesn't want to say my offensive line isn't great at pure drop back pass protection. But I'm guessing just at least the idea of play action is to slow down the linebackers and hold the line of scrimmage so you can at least deceive them in some level. So his dad, when he ran the play action, was just perfect because everything just looked identical and it was so smooth. Like those Texans teams and those Broncos teams, it just looked so smooth and you couldn't tell and guys were wide open. I find Sam is the best when that happens. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you got me thinking. I don't know if next gen stats, how far back it goes. Oh, only to 2018.
Oh, I'd love to see like 2010, 20.
Yeah, it would be really cool to see the play action rates, all the way back then. But yeah, I mean, just recapping for people that haven't been paying as close attention to this as us crazies are. The Seahawks run play action on 26% of their dropbacks. That ranks ninth in the NFL.
It's a big jump up for him, to be honest.
It is. The top percentage of play action in the NFL is the Rams, 35%. So you're talking about roughly a 10% difference between Sean McVay and Clint Kubiak in this case. But for what it's worth, like the San Francisco 49ers, a Kyle Shanahan offense, they rank 29th.
Yeah, they don't do a lot of it with Purdy.
It's like 19%.
With Jimmy, I think they had to do a lot more protecting of him. But with Purdy, they've done a lot. In the last year and a half, they switched to a lot more drop back and letting him kind of just read. It's amazing to watch San Francisco against like the bad defenses where just guys are running wide open on crossers every time. And it's like you watch every other team, and it's like it doesn't look like that. And usually when they had all those superstars and the offensive line was a lot better, it made more sense. But they're still obviously against different – like they haven't played a good team in a while. San Francisco, they haven't played a good defense in probably 6-7 weeks, so it's probably not the best. Everyone's like, oh, the Niners are back. I'm like, let's see them play a real team. If they do that against this defense or against the Rams or whoever they play in the playoffs, okay, we can talk. But yeah, it's pretty wild that San Francisco, which the whole thing was that what he did so well with Jimmy when they went to those runs with them, where they could just, their run game was so dominant. It doesn't look like that with Purdy. They've kind of built in some new trust in him over the last year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting about the 49ers. I do believe their offense is really good and challenging, partially because of Shanahan, partially because of Purdy. I've just never gotten quite caught up in this whole Purdy's a fraud or like this whole debate about him. Like, I mean, I think he's a very good player. He's a very tough player to go up against. He's smart. He makes a lot of good throws. He's very resourceful. So I don't I don't think Christian McCaffrey is as explosive as he was, but he's still a workhorse right now. And the thing there is George Kittle rolled his ankle against the Colts, and he didn't practice yesterday. And there are some folks, including that internet doc, David Chow, who's like, they should think about not playing him till the playoffs and make sure he's ready. And I'm like, really? Like, can you imagine if they don't play him this week against the Bears?
I'd be pretty surprised. They said it's like the lower graded high ankle, like the lower, not high ankle sprain.
Not a high ankle, yeah.
Yeah, lower grade sprain, which is usually like a 1 to 2 week injury at best. And what made them so scared the other night is when Kittle is rolling like that, and he looked at like the peak of his powers, he was just dominating early in the game. And when he's going with their receivers and with McCaffrey, it's a really hard team to defend because they can just beat you at everything. And when you take him out, there's a big difference. Even the first game of the year when he went out versus – and Jake Ton just made another one of those catches in the end zone that should have stood. It gave me some bad PTSD from the first half, the first game of the Seahawks. But Kittle, when Kittle's rolling and he looks dominant, he does get hurt a ton. But he's the scariest part of their team, I think, right now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I wonder about is if you're Kyle Shanahan, do you let the injury situation leak into your mind at all? Or you're like, man, we have every single guy who could get injured has been injured. Maybe we do protect ourselves since we already have clinched a playoff spot. Maybe we're not as worried about the seeding, but I mean, they could have the number one overall seed. I just can't imagine them. Let me put it this way. If they don't go all for it this week against the Bears, and they lose, then I really have to wonder who they're going to play next week against the Seahawks. Like, the logic would be that they would rest some guys if they don't go all out this week. I don't know why they would go all out if that number one seed's not even on the line.
Yeah, like ideally, like they would love to spoil the Seahawks at their own stadium and take away their number one seed. But if you do that and they lose this week, you're then giving the Rams the number one seed, who in their mind might be a more feared competitor. So I don't know if that's their best strategy. I think that's a short-sighted move because they have beaten the Rams already this year, but McDonald, I don't know who he would view McDonald or McVay as more of a threat to them, but I think you would have to say the Rams at this point.
Yeah. What do you think is better for the Seahawks? The 49ers winning on Sunday and eliminating the Rams from the division and number one overall seed competition, or 49ers losing and they are eliminated from the number one overall seed competition?
The latter option. I think the 49ers losing and losing motivation and focusing more long term is definitely the best. Because I don't think, and even if we add that, it makes the whole game week 18 a little different, but I don't think there's a huge difference from like the Rams standpoint, whether they're the one seed or the five seed. I think they're going to crush either Carolina or Tampa in the playoffs. And then you might have to play them in the first round as the one seed. So I think the far better scenario would be the Niners losing to the Bears, proving to be a bit fraudulent. And then maybe they kind of focus on getting into the playoffs. And then that takes them completely out of the one seed. I think that's your biggest hump to overcome right now. And anything that takes away from that is a huge advantage to the Seahawks.
As far as Seahawks injury news, we got their first official practice in the books yesterday, although they did practice before that. And Charles Cross, Kobe Bryant didn't practice. I don't think they're going to play.
Doesn't sound like it.
And otherwise, everyone was fine. So pretty good injury report. I was a little bit bracing for a game like that on a Thursday night that was that physical, that there was going to be some name that pops up that we're like, whoa. But no, it's in pretty good shape. And then Carolina, generally in pretty good shape as well. Tet McMillan did not practice, but it was not injury related. They're just resting him, which is interesting for a rookie.
Yeah.
Trevon Wallace, linebacker, and Treshawn Wharton, the defensive tackle, did not practice. Those guys have missed a couple games themselves. But Ike Ekwonu, their left tackle, practiced fully. J.C. Horn practiced fully. So I think they're in pretty decent shape.
Yeah, and Robert Hunt, who's been on IR, has not only opened up the window, he was a full participant or limited participant in practice. And he's a really good guard. I think if I'm them, I'm probably saving him for the Week 18 game, which is a big deal for them to make the playoffs. They're going to have to beat Tampa regardless of what happens this week unless the Bucs lose this game, but that doesn't affect them. But if he's playing, that really helps them. That's a big upgrade at guard, but I would be pretty surprised if they play him this week with that Week 18 being so big.
Yeah, everything I heard from Panthers folks is that this would be unlikely this week, that he's, you know, going to get back into kind of football shape, and for him to be gone this whole season and then start, you know, then with only a couple days of practice, that seems pretty quick. I think they're going to save him for Tampa. That game's a much bigger thing. And they might even save him for the playoffs, depending on what's going on there. I think they're definitely a scarier team with Robert Hunt back at guard and Austin Corbett moved back to center. Cause I think they've been kind of weaker at two spots with him out.
Yeah. And the thing that when they're rolling, their offensive line is the best part of their team. Mm-hmm. And they spent a lot of money on guards and lost, like a ton of money on guards. Hunt and Damian Lewis, who started off the year really well. I think he's come back to earth over the second half. But that's the running game, and what they can do is by far the best part of that team. And so if they can have that on Tampa, I think they need that to compete with some of these teams in the playoffs. They're going to need to play control of the clock. Because if they get into shootouts with some of these teams, like the Rams, I don't think they're going to win that game again.
So I don't know if you saw this on Twitter, but this was pretty funny or pretty cool, depending on your perspective. Julian Love yesterday, we walked into the press, like in the indoor practice facility where they're going to do the press conferences, and lined up were all of these golf bags, and they're these Vessel golf bags. They are super slick. Vessel Golf, if you're listening, we'll be happy to, you know, take you on as a sponsor. But and then they had these Benintendi, I think they're called, putters, place out of Chicago. And I don't know if you're going to be able to hear very well, but the guy's reaction. First of all, Shamar Jean Charles in the far left taking his putter and swinging it like. Ellis as hell because he's not a secondary.
Look at Darnold there. Look at Darnold sneaking up.
So it was pretty funny because Spoon was like, ooh, you know, he was freaking out. He's like, I have to take this to the game, man. And I don't think any of them really, most of them don't even know how to play golf. But
did you have to like hold Brady Henderson back from like sneaking his way over there?
he was pacing it, man. Before they came out, he was like looking really closely. It was funny, man. So
that's awesome. Good for love, man.
That was pretty cool. That was pretty cool. Yeah. I felt like they missed a little bit of an opportunity. They all had their names and numbers stitched into them. It looked really nice with the Seahawks green, but it didn't say MOB. I felt like the dark black bag with an MOB on there would have been pretty sick, but that was cool. So one other sound I wanted to play for you is, I think something that we've talked about a little bit, but I think deserves a little bit more of late, which is, remember when the Seahawks were struggling at home and everybody was like, maybe it's the defense, maybe they can't communicate. And there was some acknowledgement of that, but what happened this past week, I think it was Ernest. There's a couple of different people that acknowledged that, like, they just were miscommunicating and said part of it was crowd noise. So I asked Adam Dirty yesterday, the defense coordinator, why, like, for someone who doesn't get it, why would you not just rely on hand signals? If you can't hear each other, why wouldn't you just turn more to hand signals? And here is what AD said. I thought it was really, really helpful.
Yeah, you have to, but you also have to understand that you're giving away information the more you do that. You know, like, so it's the balance of both, and we have to keep working on like weaponizing our home, and I think we're doing a good job of it, but we have to keep pushing it. We have the sound up loud here. We have to work on silent communication, understand those things, how we practice, how we do it to play at home at a high level.
Jeff, I thought that was perfect answer, and I think hopefully it addresses a little bit about why they can't just figure out a way to have this not be an issue. Offenses communicate silently.
Yeah, it was super revealing too, because they've had a lot of big games where they just have had breakdowns, and it seemed like they've had communication errors. Like the Tampa game, there was a ton of them, and there was a lot of guys who didn't used to play, but Julian Love not being there and things like that. And last week you saw a lot of like the breakdowns. There was that big Xavier Smith play, and there were some of the Puka plays, and it's just McDonald's defense is so complex. And he even acknowledged after the game where it's like, I probably put too much on these guys this in a short week. But it was very interesting to hear Aiden Dirty say that out loud and just say they need to figure out a way to make it simpler, because it seems like one of the knocks on McDonald in some of these big games where I'd like to see the defense take over against some of the better teams, it does seem communication errors at home have been a consistent issue, and that's something they're going to need to figure out, especially if they're the one seed. That's something they're going to need to figure out, because this defense is so complex. And what they did in Baltimore to Purdy and what they did in Baltimore to Geno, like, we haven't seen a ton of that against some of the other quarterbacks, unless different personnel. This defense is special. I think that's the one thing really holding this team back. I think some of those communication breakdowns, some people think maybe this is too complex, but yeah, I'm glad they're working on it. I'm glad they're self-scouting. And I thought that was a very telling answer.
Did you, speaking of, I'm going around different places, but did you see any of the Jordan Poyer interview with Tyler Dunn, so former safety, played for the Dolphins, played for Bills, Dolphins, whatever. Anyway, it was about a bunch of stuff, and I'm not going to get into that, but there's this one aspect where he spent time talking about Anthony Weaver's defense in Miami. And how I'll try to find the exact quote, because I think it's worth Poyer Weaver. Okay, let me see if I can find it so I can. Okay, so this is what he said. He said nobody understood Anthony Weaver's system during his time in the Dolphins. It was the first time in my career I felt alone on the field. It's one of the worst feelings. You're out there having to guard everything. I didn't understand our defense. Nobody understood our defense. I can understand concepts of how an offense is trying to attack us, but if I don't know where the guy next to me knows where he's supposed to go, it's draining. It took a lot out of me mentally, physically, emotionally. That's Mike McDonald's defense. Curious your reactions to that.
So this is the thing where I've wondered about, because like, remember with Bill Belichick in his heyday, you could, people were always trying to poach Bill Belichick's guys, and they always wanted them to be Belichick. And you could never, and even Pete's guys to an extent, but Belichick was the best one, where you could get Matt Patricia, or you can get all these guys, but you could never get Belichick. And McDonald, I think his defense is super complex, super complicated. It's why there's that first window everywhere it's been where they really struggle. But the thing, I know Jordan Rodriguez has done a lot on this, where she was tied in with the Rams. What the thing McDonald and his staff are really good at, and this might just be a Mike thing, is teaching, is the way they communicate complex things to a very basic level. And when people have been around Mike and they try to have that Mike defense, but they don't have that part down, if you have the complexity of the defense but not the teaching part and simplifying it, that's what you get. You get a Miami situation where guys are overwhelmed. They don't understand. Poyer's been on a ton of different defenses, Green Bay, and he's been around for years. And so I think that's very telling, because that's what McDonald's not only known for is the complexity and the strategy. It's the basics of teaching. And that's what all those Rams people were very nervous about him coming to the division. And that's, you might be able to poach McDonald's people, and I bet you people are going to start trying. But I do wonder if it's going to be that Belichick effect, where you saw it come out of Baltimore that year. Tennessee got its guy, and they haven't had super success, but they haven't had great personnel. But I wonder if that's going to be the thing, where there's only one, like McVay's guys have done pretty well. But so I think with some of the defensive guys, with Belichick and even Pete, we had that people tried to be Pete, but they couldn't. There's only one Pete Carroll. And you can do the systems, and you can do, but there's no one who can think like him and be like him. I think that might happen with McDonald.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be that stark. Extreme. Because look at Jesse Minter in Los Angeles. I think even Denard Wilson in Tennessee has done relatively well with what he's had to work with. I think there's some evidence of it being able to be run by some other people, but I think the general point is exactly right that you're making. It's not just the system, it's the teaching of it, and it is sophisticated. And if you don't know how to convey those concepts, you're going to have some real challenges. And so part of what is interesting to me about that, besides how portable the system is it is sophisticated. And then you get into the communication stuff, where they're talking about that being an issue. I still in my head can't quite wrap my head, or I can't wrap my head around the idea that offense can operate silently, but defense can't, because offense is not giving things away and defense is.
That's a hard one.
That one doesn't totally square for me, but I'll say this. When I took a walk yesterday, because there's a long break between Mike McDonald and player and locker room access, and then the coordinators. And when I was out walking on the trail by the VMAC, the sound for practice was super loud. I mean, I was a mile away and I could still hear it. So I think they are taking this seriously. They practiced outside. It was cold, a little wet, rained a little bit. I think they're preparing for playoff home games.
It's being self-aware and being and not naive, and like, seems like some of the older Seahawks staffs were never trying to solve the recurring issues that would haunt this team. So I think one of the best things about Mike and in dirty and the whole staff is they self-scout really well. You saw him coming out of the bye last week. I think they're very understanding of what their issues are and what they need to get better at, and prepping for home playoff games. That's crazy still. We got a long way to go in these next 2 weeks, but holy shit. You would have told me they might be the number one seed.
I know, man. It's wild. I'm going to have to go back and look at some of our predictions, see where we are. In fact, let's take a little detour real quick. I am curious. We won't go through all of these, but I'm curious where some of them are. Folks, if you haven't given the show a like already and click subscribe, please do. We're up over 31,000 subs, which is great. Love to add you to the family. Predictions. Okay, 2025 predictions. All right, so not at the win-loss, but I'm looking at the prop predictions we made. We've already joked about the JSN receiving yards. We're all way below what he's already at. Cooper Kupp touchdowns. That's an interesting one. How many touchdowns do you think Cooper Kupp has this year?
Five?
I don't know. I'm going to look. People can guess in chat while I'm looking it up. Cooper Kupp has... He has two.
Really?
Two touchdowns. And he just had one. I think, what was it, Atlanta?
In Atlanta.
Right? So we're all too high on that, at least so far. Who will be the second leading receiver in yards? I'm like curious. It was on the pace to be Horton. Who do you think's the second leading receiver right now?
Barner?
It's Cooper Kupp.
Okay.
Cooper Kupp, 558.
Anyone hit that one?
Yes, you did. Evan did. Dana did. Derek and Josh.
That's a lot.
I had this belief that Elijah Arroyo might be the guy. So shows you.
I thought it would take time with him, but
yeah,
I'm still pretty high on him.
As far as who is going to lead the team in sacks, I'm guessing you know who's leading the team in sacks right now.
Williams?
Two ties.
Williams and Murphy?
Williams and Murphy. Seven sacks. And there is nobody that guessed Byron Murphy. A few people guessed Leonard Williams. So the most probably comically false guess of who would be who would be the first coach fired, and I had Shane Steichen. So
well, there's talk he might be out.
Really?
Yeah.
How could that possibly be?
Because it's a new owner that the daughter took over the team, and they have it's not deserved, but they have a history. Like, this whole regime has been really disappointing, and they haven't made the playoffs. And they were 7-1, and they're now probably going to end up 8-9 at best. There's talk that the daughters might blow the thing up and hire their own people, even though everyone said Steichen does not deserve it. But there's chatter that might happen if they go 0-2 to end the year.
Man,
it's just been such a mess for that whole organization since Luck retired.
Let's turn our attention to some super chats and Patreon questions. We'll start with Patreon, patreon.com/hawkblogger. And let me get to, we're way back in the time machine here. Let me get further down. By the way, patreon.com/hawkblogger gets you ad-free audio for this show, as well as access to all the exclusive audio, like the locker room stuff that I do. And access to the Discord server where you can ask us questions. So, all right. I missed this one. This is from Scott in the 503. This says, for me, we hear a lot of praise for a few of the offensive position coaches, but what about on defense? Has a veteran coach like Kirk Olivadotti been instrumental in all the linebackers overachieving, or does more credit go to McDonald's scheming? You can answer that one, Jeff. What's your take?
It's a really tough question to answer without being around the building and knowing what the individual coaches are doing and who's standing out, because they seem to be like a sum of its parts group. Or I think the linebacker coach has been really good. Carl Scott's a guy they're really, really high on. I think the D-line coach, they've been really, Justin Hines, they've credited him with a lot. But I think the way it's going to work in those situations is it's always when there's that genius mastermind, we're never going to know who willingly deserve the credit. But I think they're very high on their internal coaches and the position coaches they have. And a lot of those defensive guys were the guys they initially plucked. They didn't make a lot of changes there. And really, the guy who was kind of comical, we were talking about him getting fired off last year, and Jay Harbaugh might be the best coach on their staff this year. And he was a guy a lot of people were furious about. So
I want to be clear, there's other people on this show that was talking about firing him. I was never on the fire Jay Harbaugh train. I was kind of confused by it, to be honest, but they had a really bad game against the Jets. That was like,
that was maybe the worst special teams game.
It was really bad.
You've ever seen, but even the preseason, we were like, is he the one guy slagging a little bit? And
yeah,
he's had a great year.
I thought Kirk Olivadotti was actually one of the guys I did have question about, because he comes in, he didn't have a great track record. Like, his Green Bay linebackers were not very good. And then, Tyrell Dodson and you know, Jerome Baker didn't work out. I was like, ooh, maybe that was not a great hire. But, you know, they certainly are getting great play from the off-ball linebacker group now.
Drake Thomas this year.
And I think Carl Brooks is, I'll be surprised if he sticks around that much longer. I think that guy should be a DC somewhere. He's a really good coach. They got a lot of good players, a lot of good coaches on that side.
Yeah.
This one comes from Amy Holmes. The great Amy Holmes says in YouTube chat today, in reference to your article about John Schneider, the issue of Jody Allen as an ignorant owner came up again. It seems to me that she has really worked to be part of the process and understand all the moving parts of a football team. Why do people still seem to focus on this after so much improvement? I don't know.
Ignorant?
Yeah, I think this must just be like...
I would get like absentee, because like some of the owners in the NFL are so present. And like Jerry Jones has a radio show after every game, and Arthur Blank's face is everywhere, Atlanta. But I haven't heard ignorant. Like, if I understand, the people that who run her all like football operation are very involved. They're very knowledgeable. And I have not heard that at all. I seem even she's in the draft room trying. Yeah. John's talked about how she has questions. She wants to know. I have questions. You could ask maybe absentee with some of those other years, but that's ignorant would be an odd choice of words.
Yeah. I mean, I think she is not highly visible.
Yeah.
And so we don't hear much from her. So I think it's hard to know where she is, but you can assess her as an owner by the decisions that she's made and her process for making those decisions. And look, everyone was trying to just come at her so hard when Pete and John were there and the team was struggling. It was like, oh, they're just going to hold on to these guys until it's time to sell. They're kind of an absentee group. And they fired Pete Carroll or let him go when they still owed him a lot of money. And a lot of owners, like, especially if you're an absentee owner, you don't do that. And then the fact of the matter is that you're signing up for not just doing that, but you're keeping John Schneider. So you're putting a crosshair on yourself for making it like one and not the other. And you're signing yourself up to be part of a head coaching search and have work to do, where a lot of these owners, again, if you're absentee, you're not signing up to get off your yacht to go, you know, deal with coach search. So I think Jody Allen, even the parts of this that she has chose to delegate, I think have been positive. And I think you don't have to do everything to get credit for it. I think she's essentially gets credit for everything that happens with the Seahawks since she's taken over, because she could have decided at any point to do something totally different.
Yeah, your job when you're running an organization or running an operation is to put the right people in place and stay out of the way. And so even Carolina, where that guy's been such a disaster, it seems like they've gotten better. Like, he's got Dan Morgan now and he's Dave Canales. And they've got a system. They have good people. Like, they hired some really strong analytics people. But she's put her team in place. They've been pretty stable in her management team. And then the decision to go with John Schneider, and all the, you can't really argue that decision. If you saw that poll from Tom Pelissero, he said there almost is never a runaway favorite for executive of the year, and they pulled a bunch of GMs and he got like 20 votes. So you can't really question what's going on there. They orchestrated a coaching search that they had patience. A lot of owners would have been like, what happened in Atlanta? You got to hire this guy now. You got to hire Raheem Morris. You can't let him out of the building. They let Mike McDonald out of the building. Tennessee hired Brian Callahan. They had Mike McDonald in the building. So I think the biggest decision, putting John Schneider in charge of the operation, asking the right questions about the draft, I think improving the locker room after that poll last year, or what was it, the weight room or something
the training facility. Like
I'm like, look, it would have been very easy to just keep Pete Carroll going, and you see how that's going in Vegas, and not that it takes swings at him, or a lot of people wouldn't have been okay with them trading their quarterback or trading DK Metcalf. And these are all moves that have worked in spades. Some people would have said, like, no, we're keeping DK Metcalf, pay him. Pittsburgh probably feels pretty bad about that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right, next one goes from Braxton. Which Nicky Minwari nickname goes harder, Demon Worry or Hit Stick Nick?
I like Demon Worry.
Yeah.
Hit Stick Nick seems a little corny.
Yeah. All right, so some of these questions are outdated, so I'm going to skip through these. All right. I'm going to ask folks in the Patreon RHT questions channel to not get into conversations, just ask questions and so that it's easier for me to scan through. Otherwise, I'm going to be asking actual comments instead of questions. There's a question from KYP Duran who says, has any team ever gone 3-for-3 and 2-point conversions in NFL history? I saw some stuff about this. I don't know if there's actually even a way for me to look it up. There's some definitely unique parts of it, but you know what? Like, for whatever reason, that whole anomaly is not that interesting to me. I don't know why. I'm like, to me, it's
probably just sick of hearing about that
move, that show, that yeah, that game.
I wonder if you're like me and just sick of hearing the Charbonnet conversation.
I am. I mean,
the whining from the Rams fans and even McVay was, considering they blew a 16-point lead, they missed the kick, they went 0-for-5. That was a little fanboyish. I thought that was so embarrassing. The tone come out of the Rams this week.
I came really close and I decided not to, asking DeMarcus Lawrence, like, hey, if you guys had been the team that blew a 16-point lead, do you think that Mike McDonald would be spending time talking about why the officials screwed you guys? I would have worded it differently, but I just know DeMarcus would have he would have had something to say about it, but I chose to not do that because I mean it's annoying and maybe I'm alone in this, but I think there is a 0.0% chance that Mike McDonald would be talking about the refs days later or that they need to change the rules or anything like that. I think he would be completely talking about the fact that they can't give up a punt return touchdown. They've got to put the game away when they have a chance to. They've got to finish all that stuff. So I think it's been a really bad look on Sean McVay. He looks like a spoiled child.
Yeah, I saw someone say they're acting like a kid who had his toy taken away.
Yeah.
It's like, look, if that was the only play in the game that was like 35-34 back and forth, like I get it to an extent, but you guys lost the game. Like you basically blew the game in your own. And you can't, if I'm a coach, I'm trying to fix those mistakes. And if they want to spend time on these rules and if they want to waste their energy whining and their fans who seem to ignore that the Rams have benefited from, like, even against the Seahawks, like there's that DJ Dallas play over the year. Remember that play? It was in a lost season for the Seahawks, but that was like the most egregious penalty. And then there's the last year, two years ago, there's Puka in the end zone and Witherspoon. That one sent me, I didn't blame the refs, but I hated that call. But there's just, even the first game, there's a lot of bad calls. But look, that fat kicker makes the field goal, they probably win the game. So they can stop whining and just, they blew it. Simple as that.
They did. All right, Sweet Lou says, on a scale of 0 to 100, low and high, for the Darnold confidence meter, be honest, where are you?
65.
Yeah, I think we're in the same place.
Like, I think it was very meaningful what he did the other day. I think when they let him loose, I still don't trust him. I still don't know if he'll do it again. But I think a lot of us were at the point where during the game where that number would have been a scary answer. But I need to see more than just one really good drive. I think the fact that he did it, but I think the mistakes he's making are still concerning. I think the coaching staff is acting like they don't fully trust him based on how they're calling the games. And I think we just kind of see what he is at this point. I think it's, again, very meaningful that he was able to win that game, bounce back. So we've seen the other game spiraled, and we saw it with Geno sometimes where he would just lose his mind and couldn't get back from it. But I think 65 would be my number. I think...
You know what's one part of that game that I think got the least amount of attention that was really pivotal was the Cooper Kupp fumble.
Yes.
Because my feeling, and I'm not, I mean, I'll try to be objective. I thought they were going in for a touchdown, like after that, like the way that drive was going and the way things, like their offense, I know I had a different opinion of the offensive play calling that first half, but I thought they were going to score there.
On that play or just in the drive?
No, on that drive. He was going to get tackled, and then I thought they were going to end up with a touchdown. If they had, and then they came out in the first possession of the second half and go again, it would have been 21-13.
Like, oh, yeah, and it would have been, and then they did the whole feel of the game would have been different, because even though the Walker got that play right away, it only gave them the 1 point lead, and it still felt like the gut punch. They hadn't had any of those Darnold interceptions yet, but that
right,
it felt like the game had turned when like they had that Zach Charbonnet second and one, and they threw it twice and didn't convert, and then it just kind of spiraled after that. And then the cup thing was like the punch in the gut, right, when it felt like the game was spiraling. But yeah, that could have completely changed the tone of the game. You score going into half and you score coming out of half. Because really it was that Darnold pick that brought them to the 1 yard line, which really gave the Rams that score back. Because even on the drive where they throw the pick to Kobe Turner, like they're driving, they're moving the ball. It would have been a lot more of a different game in context. It was just the interception from Darnold after that cup fumble. It was such a, like, it just felt like the team wasn't ready and felt like some of the old Green Bay games. So yeah, I think that would have completely changed the game and it would have completely changed the context. And that's where all these plays matter.
All right. Imani says, in a league where things change drastically every week, how concerned are we about a Carolina team that has a reputation for coming out of nowhere to beat contenders? I'll add to what Imani wrote there that the Panthers have beat the number one seed at the time, Green Bay Packers in Green Bay. They beat the number one seed at the time, LA Rams. And now they're welcoming in another number one seed at the moment, the Seattle Seahawks. So what's your take, Jeff?
Well, based on David Lombardi's rationale, this is the best team in the NFL. But yeah, the Panthers are such a weird team because, yeah, you saw them play a great game against the Rams. And then back into that, they looked horrible against New Orleans. And Tyler Shock has actually, for your draft analysis, Tyler Shock's been pretty good. But this team is just so jacked. Even the first half last week, Bryce Young looked horrible. He couldn't get around a play. And then in the second half, he looked completely in command. He made some really good plays on the run. He made some professional throws, like those where layering the ball over the top. It's a really Jekyll and Hyde team. They have some good players. They're well coached, but they just have some real limitations on their roster. Their defense does not have great personnel. They're very limited at receiver. You can really throw Bryce Young off his game. So it's a really Jekyll and Hyde team, which is a sign. If when you're that Jekyll and Hyde, it's a sign you're a mediocre team. It's like the ultimate sign of it. We've seen it in some of those Pete Carroll years. But that's what they are. They're building something. They're run by Pete Carroll people. It's a big positive energy group. But they're really limited in terms of like high-end skill players. They don't have a lot of blue chips other than Derek Brown in the middle.
Yes, agreed. Agreed. That is a key part of it. So couple more here. We'll get some super chats and make our picks. KYP Duran says, we're super late in the year, but what is the chance that Seattle leaves Josh Jones at left tackle and moves Cross to a guard spot? Continuity is important, but having our best five on the field is also important. Is your best five Jones, Cross, Zabel, Bradford, and Lucas, or Jones, Cross, Sundell, Zabel, and Lucas? So I'll shift this around. There's zero chance Charles Cross is playing guard. I think there's Josh Jones has played some guard in his career, so let's just put him out there. Should Josh Jones be out there at guard instead of Anthony Bradford, let's say?
I think it's way, way too late in the year for any consideration of this. They're going to go with their guys at this point. Moving tackles to guards is like something you do in desperation mode, or if your O-line's a complete disaster. I don't see this happening at all. And I think it's classic call-in radio kind of stuff. And it's a fair question. I guess Josh Jones did look competent, but the thing with Josh Jones and with a lot of backups in general is you need to see it over a longer period of time. I don't think you're going to week 17 just completely flip your O-line. I think they would have tried that when Bradford was looking really bad. If that was not, and another big thing is you can't really switch guys' sides at this point of the year. Like that's a huge adjustment to any offensive lineman where their feet have to change. And so no, when Charles Cross plays, he's going to be the left tackle. Josh Jones will hold up as much as they can. They're playing the two worst edge rush groups in the league coming up. So that's a big deal, but no. But if you want to see a cool offensive line moment, put on the Shaheed reverse play and watch Jalen Sundell. If you want to see why he's playing versus Olu, he hasn't had a lot of these plays. He's not like Drew Dahlman's played great, but if you want to see like the best of Jalen Sundell, put on that play. I saw the clip of the Shaheed play come up, and I couldn't stop watching Sundell on that play. He looks awesome. He still has some issues, but it's the best play he's made probably all year.
Yeah, I saw your comment on that. It was a good call out. I hadn't noticed it until you brought it up. So that was good stuff. All right, one more here. Andy Davis says, Brian, based on your interactions, you can have a beer or beverage of choice with any Seahawk, including coaching staff currently on the team, in a cozy dive bar with your choice of conversation. Who's it going to be and why? I think it would be probably Mike McDonald. Close would be Ad and Dirty. I think those two guys, I just think they're interesting guys. I think there's a lot to learn there. They're pretty laid back. And yeah, I think those probably be toward the top of the list. Otherwise, like player wise, AJ Barner, probably top of that list. Really good guy and interesting guy too, for sure. So yeah, those are probably my answers. All right. That was patreon.com/hawkblogger. You can ask us questions each and every week. Appreciate you all for signing up and participating in the Discord as well. So Jeff, that gets us to picks, and let me see if I can get this set up in a way that doesn't just screw everything up. We'll try. So let's talk about this game. As I get ready for the picks here, what kind of stands out to you when you're assessing?
Look, I think Carolina's a sneaky team. I think you can't take them lightly. They've beaten Green Bay. They've beaten the Rams. They play very hard. But I think Seattle's just personnel advantages and the fact that they need to win both these games to get that number one seed. If they just need to win the San Francisco game, this game would be the trap game. It would scare me. It would be a lot like that Colts game where they kind of just knew they had to just do the bare minimum and they'd pull it out. But I think that we need to see them peaking going into the playoffs. I think this is a game where we haven't seen their defensive line take over in a couple of weeks. And when they were really rolling, like, we just saw this defense. And I'm glad the NFL managed to piss off Byron Murphy with that absolutely inane snub. Yeah. That was, to me, I wrote a tweet out yesterday. I'm not going to get mad at the Pro Bowl, and proceeded to completely ignore my own advice and get very mad at the Pro Bowl. And so I think Murphy.
This was Byron Murphy on his Instagram account. It says the headline of the picture is Byron Murphy led all defensive tackles in fan Pro Bowl voting, but didn't make the Pro Bowl. And Byron Murphy's caption on his story yesterday, fuck him. I promise you all ass gonna keep feeling the slime. So, yeah, I talked to Byron yesterday, said it to a number of the other reporters, and he's not happy. He's certainly not happy about
it. And it'd be weird because, like, if you didn't have the counting stats and you needed to, like, see the charts, but he's got the counting stats and the fans voted for him. So if you look at the defensive tackle chart that goes out, like, him and Leonard Williams are side by side. And I'm glad Leo got his spot this year. I'm glad D-Law got his spot this year. But Murphy, to me, was like one of those guys I didn't even think about.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right. Let's do our picks. Do you want to make any picks for today, or you want to go to just the Seahawks game?
No, there's too many third string. I don't know how these games are going
to
go.
Yeah, it's so weird. I just don't even care, to be honest.
Yeah, if I didn't have to go inside to play with a baby in a few minutes, I would not be watching football.
All right, so we're in the sleeper app here looking at picks. You know who I was thinking about? Gosh, I literally, like, had a dream about it, I think. Someone getting a touchdown in this game for the Seahawks that's not – gosh, who was it? I don't know. Maybe it'll come up here. So – what's kind of on your mind for this one? Let me get to any time.
Well, we've been hammering the Shahid receiving lines every week because they seem to fade him every week. And
last week didn't go well for us.
No, though. He got zero.
What are we thinking about receiving
yards? What are receiving yards? Oh my god, like that's such a juicy line again. Such a juicy pick. 27 yards for him.
All right. So here's the thing, JSN is going to go over 100 yards in this game, I think.
Yeah, this is the game for him. They don't have, like, the rush.
They don't have the pass rush. I think he's going to torch them.
What's Barner at?
Barner's at 31.5.
Yeah, Barner over Shahid. Interesting.
They're pretty bad against tight ends.
Yeah, that's why I asked.
So here's one that I think feel pretty strongly about. Ken Walker over 12.5 receiving yards. They play almost all zone, and Ken Walker has just eviscerated zone as a receiver. So I kind of like that one.
Yeah, let's take that one. Is Ken Walker ever going to get a touchdown other than a 50-yard run? Are they going to give him?
I don't know, man.
You interviewed him the other day.
Yeah, it was a good conversation. It was nice that we got a chance to kind of get to know him a little bit better. What do you think? Like rushing yards, I feel like is big in this game. The Panthers are not a great run defense. Seahawks have been coming on. Do you believe enough to take the more on either Ken Walker or Zach Charbonnet?
Kind of like the Charbonnet in this game.
Okay. All right.
Although, like, I would love to say Walker and comfortably say it, but every week, based on the coaching staff, I don't know what I'm getting here. So every time I've been ready to believe in Walker, the thing kind of turns against me. So I would love to see if Ken Walker has a game like he did last week. That makes this team so much better.
Yeah, I like that. I think we got to add something for the Panthers.
Under
like 201 yards passing for Bryce Young. Is he going to hit that? Receiving yards.
So they're not high on any of these guys.
No, they're not. Yeah, I mean, passing touchdowns for Bryce Young.
Yeah, I can go with the less than 1.5.
Less than, yeah, so one or fewer. I think that makes sense.
I think one seems right.
Okay. All right. Well, so make sure you download the Sleeper app if you haven't already. And if you use promo code Hawks, you also will get up to $100 off on your first deposit. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. All right, Jeff. Let's make our final picks. What is going to happen in this game? What's the final score?
I think it's going to be an uncomfortable first half, and then the second half, the cream rises to the top. So I think it's going to be very similar to the Jaguars game. And pretty amazing that Jaguars team is now one of the favorites in the AFC, because when we played them, they just got rolled. So I'm going to say 24-13 Seattle.
Okay. I think this is a game where the Seahawks offense is going to put up points. I really do.
I hope so. I really hope so.
And I think just about everything the Seahawks want to do, they should be able to do against this team. The biggest downside or like question mark for me is that they play a lot of zone. Sam Darnold has had more challenges with zone this year. I finally was able to find what I was looking for statistically. He's been much better against man. And they do pick the ball off a lot. So that's the one kind of question mark. I think they're going to be able to run the ball. I think they're going to be able to pass protect. And I think that the receivers are and the tight end are going to be open. I just think there's going to be – Seahawks are going to score 30 points at least, I think, in this game. I'll give the Panthers 17. But I think the Seahawks are going to win this game relatively comfortably. And that's not because I don't respect the Panthers. I just think the Seahawks are a really tough matchup for them across the board. So I think the Seahawks take care of business this week. And then we're talking about a winner takes all week.
Number 18. One seed game.
Yeah.
Well, the 49ers Bears game is super important for Seahawks fans, because if you're the Seahawks, if the 49ers win that game and the Rams go 2-0, if the Seahawks do lose to the Niners, they would drop all the way to the sixth seed. If the Bears beat them, the worst the Seahawks could be if they win one of the games is the five seed. And that's a very different first round opponent. So it's going to be very fun to root for the Bears this week. But yeah, the Seahawks Panthers game, massive. Obviously, they got to go 2-0.
Almost missed these super chats. Sorry about that. Hawks fan says Die Hard is absolutely a Christmas movie. Okay. That is fine if you believe that to be the case. Landon Howell, happy holidays week, boys. Beers on me. Well, thanks, man. Appreciate it, Landon. And then we got a couple of from Space FTW's gifted 20 Hawk Blogger memberships. Really appreciate it, man. And thanks to everybody who's tuned in on this Christmas day. Hopefully you enjoy the rest of your day. Jeff, man, good seeing you. We won't be able to do a Seahawks Saturday. I'll be flying. So we'll talk again, maybe post game show on Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be around for that for sure. And if not, we're going to have a big show on Wednesday.
We will. All right, everybody. Take care. That'll do it for this episode of Real Hawk Talk.